On this episode of the Taking a Walk series, I'm heading to the Back Bay in Boston, and I'm going to be taking a walk with my old friend, Dr. Carl Marcy. I first met Carl some years ago when I was part of the Council for Research Excellence, which was a Nielsen-funded think tank with a bunch of great researchers. Carl was working for Nielsen then with the neuroscience division that he had founded some years ago, and it was really cool getting to meet him and understand neuroscience from a guy who could speak English, so a guy like me could understand it. Carl has a brand new book. It's called Rewired, Protecting Your Brain in the Digital Age, and I can't wait to take a walk with Carl Marcy.
Taking a walk with Buzz Knight.
Well, Carl, it's so good to be taking a walk with you in person in lovely Boston. We're right now on Boylston Street in the Back Bay. How are you, Carl?
I'm good. I'm particularly good because it's nice to walk without a mask on for the first time in a long time.
Isn't it nice?
Yeah, it's refreshing.
It's nice to see people's faces, to see smiles, right?
I hope it lasts. As a physician, I'm slightly nervous that it's a little premature, but let's enjoy the spring while we can.
Exactly. Well, we have a lot to talk about. We want to talk about your new book, which is something really exciting that you've worked on. But let's figure out, first of all, your journey, and we could kind of intersperse how you and I first connected. How did you get to be this person that wanted to study the brain?
Yeah, so I was a psychology undergraduate, and at the time, I won't date myself, but let's just say neuroimaging and the ability to take pictures of a healthy human brain was relatively new and very exciting. And when I got to medical school and started literally studying the brain in detail, I fell in love. And you have three options in medical school if you fall in love with the brain. You could be a neurologist, a neurosurgeon, or a psychiatrist. And neurosurgeons just, you know, do surgery. They don't really talk to people. I like talking to people, so eliminated that one. Neurologists only take care of things they can see, and I was pretty sure there were things going on in the brain that we couldn't see. So I became a psychiatrist, and that started me off on the journey of brain science.
And then ultimately, your company was ultimately rolled up into Nielsen, is that correct?
That's right. So along the way, I started off as an academic psychiatrist studying the neurobiology of empathy, sort of how one brain understands another brain. And along the way, someone recommended I go to the MIT Media Lab, and we were fast friends, because they were making the first generation of what we now call wearable devices. So they were taking handheld computers and doing what MIT engineers do, taking them apart and plugging sensors in, and then literally sewing it into a vest and walking around.
But it's so
and I said, oh my goodness, you have a multi-sensing wearable computerized platform. This is amazing. They said, yeah, we don't know what to do with it. And I said, well, I have some ideas. So we started collaborating on various projects, and along came an MIT business student named Brian Levine. And when he graduated, he asked if I wanted to start a company, instead of measuring empathy, measuring audiences' responses to media marketing stimuli. And that's how Interscope Research was founded.
And that's where I met you, because at that time I was working in the radio business, and I had a corporate programming role, but also as part of that, I was fortunate to be the company's interface with Nielsen, and ultimately, I got to be part of this really cool thing called the Council for Research Excellence. And boy, that was an amazing group of people who were part of that, some legendary research people, whether it be Howard Schimmel or Dave Poltrack or Stacy Shulman. I mean, kind of a who's who of people who were part of this.
Yep.
And you came into the picture when Nielsen and you connected, and you were really the first person in my mind from, you know, someone who wasn't an academic who allowed me to understand neuroscience in a way that, you know, was human, if that makes sense, you know?
Yeah.
And I thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, when we started Interscope, which was ultimately bought by Nielsen, which is what you're referring to, I started to give talks about what we're doing. And there would be, you know, 20, 30, 40, sometimes 50 people there. And I knew they were listening. And I could tell they were engaged just by looking at them, but at the end there was never any questions. And my business partner said, I asked him, I said, why do you think no one's asking questions? And he paused and he looked at me and he said, I don't think they understand a word you're saying. So I went on a journey to sort of make neuroscience accessible, because I was talking to, you know, experts in media and market research who knew nothing about the brain. So I had to make it intelligible. I had to make it accessible. And that took a while. And the best advice I got was someone who said, well, act like you're talking to your best friend's mom, because you're going to speak a little slower. You're going to, you know, you're going to talk with empathy and kindness and interest. And, you know, that's how I imagined my audience when I would talk. I was like, I'm talking to my best friend's mother.
Now, I'm taking that all the right way, because I was the person who you should have been directing that at. Because once again, these people that I mentioned that were part of the CRE, and Nielsen funded the CRE, it was sort of this think tank, but these were these amazing analytic folks.
Oh, very smart people who knew their business well.
I was just a programmer, so I was not, you know, I was out of my league. But that's what I so loved about it, because this was a group of people that I just, you know, enjoyed collaborating with and getting to meet, you know, new people from that group. Janet Gallant was another one of these people. Richard Zakon ran the CRE. So that was a tremendous experience, and I'm grateful I got to meet you through that process for sure. And since we're both Boston-based, we would then, over time, bump into each other between haircuts.
literally.
Literally, I'm not kidding. So right now we're walking in one of the most unbelievable places that every time I walk here, I pinch myself. This is the Boston Public Garden.
Yeah, beautiful
and
place.
It's so beautiful. How do you use taking a walk, by the way, to sort of, you know, motivate yourself or re-energize yourself?
Yeah, well, I think like a scientist because of my training, and there's a lot of really good literature to support getting outside in nature, walking and thinking, that the movement of the body, the stimuli around you really kind of stimulates creativity. And I think the most important thing we can do is do it without technology and just really kind of be with ourselves or a friend, as in this case, and have a good conversation and see where it leads.
So this topic that the book is focused on is something that has come up in a couple of previous episodes of Taking a Walk. The one in particular it came up in was with the comedian Steve Sweeney.
Okay.
Steve worked for me years ago at WZLX, and he's an iconic Boston comedian. But as we were walking over in the Fresh Pond area, we had this very conversation about what's really going on with the amount of screen time that people are facing, and what it's doing to people, and how it sort of makes us sad, really, when you see those situations in restaurants where a husband and a wife aren't even talking to each other. They're each off on their, you know, their own device, or, you know, the kids are stuck on the device. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the book and how you sort of got into the mindset of its importance.
Yeah, well, we are more distracted, divided, and depressed than ever as a society. And I think that it's an open question, the causality, because it's always hard to get to the root causes of things. But as I began the journey of trying to understand the impact of mobile communications, information, and as I began the journey looking into the impact of mobile information, communication, and media technology, the literature was impressive. And there were more studies than I thought there would be. And then Interscope was doing some very leading edge work at the time. Now, when we founded Interscope, it was 2006. So it was before the iPhone. And our first big study was actually involved Janet Gallant, who you mentioned, and NBC Universal. and it was on the impact of the DVR and fast-forwarding through commercials. And could people get a commercial impression even when things were fast-forwarded? Because they had data from recall and other measures that showed that even when they were skipping ads, people were actually getting something and what was going on. Well, a couple years later, nobody cared about the DVR anymore. And it was all about, what is this iPhone? What are these smartphones? How is Facebook going to impact our business? Now, this is now 2007, 2008, 2009. And so we were working not directly with Facebook, but with the large media companies, Time Warner, NBC, Fox, and others, to understand the impact on television, traditional television, that social media had. So we were doing studies in the early days, and I would go to conferences and listen to the Facebook researchers and present my own research. And I knew they were lying back then, because we had eye tracking data and we had sophisticated neuroscience data that told us exactly how much people were engaging with their ads. And then they would get up and tell a very different story. So that made me concerned. I never joined Facebook as a result of that. But I became intrigued as time went on to learn more.
Why didn't you join Facebook? Was it as a result of those learnings, or was there something before that? Because you're talking to another person who's never joined Facebook either, and me.
Yeah, I think in the beginning I was just sort of on the fence. Did I need another, social channel? I was more into face-to-face conversation, and I think it was just an intuition. But then when I started, doing the research and realized that this, may be a company of, that I don't trust fully, or that maybe doesn't have the best interest in of people at versus profits, that made me concerned. So I just stayed off it, and I don't really regret it, other than how do I promote my book not being on Facebook, right?
Exactly. So how will you promote the book? You'll do, hopefully, walks like this, talks like this.
Yeah.
I mean, you're, recognized as an expert in your field, so people will come towards you to want to hear what you have to say as a result of that, right?
Yeah, and I'm a healthcare entrepreneur. In addition to an author, and so I'm not immune to social media. I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm on Twitter professionally, and I'll continue those channels to promote. But like you said, I think it's really about having a good publicist and doing interviews and podcasts like this and others to get the word out.
And mentioned your current job in terms of what is happening with that. Tell me how excited you are about it.
Yeah, so after we sold Interscope, and I was the first global chief neuroscientist at Nielsen for 4 years, I had a yearning to get back into healthcare. I had thought to myself, maybe I learned a little something about business, and maybe I could contribute at the interface of healthcare, technology, and business. And so I've now been involved in 4 or 5 health technology companies, venture-backed. Currently, I just signed on to be the chief psychiatrist and managing director of the mental health and neuroscience specialty area for a company called OM1. It's a big company that does big data that you never heard of because it works quietly in the background. We take healthcare information from electronic health records and pharmacy and insurance claims and other data sources, and we organize them, clean them, and link them together in the cloud, and then mine them for insights that help life science companies bring medications to market sooner, help insurance companies understand the costs and trade-offs of doing certain types of treatments. And ultimately, the goal is personalized care. So when I'm in my clinic, which I still see patients through Mass General, periodically Mrs. Jones comes in, and I can put her profile into a computer, and I will compare her profile against, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of other patients like her, and tell me which medication or treatment she'll respond to for her depression or her anxiety. That's the big goal.
So do you think the state of healthcare really is bad now?
It hasn't been good for a while, and I think the pandemic showed a lot of the inequities in the system, and also just how difficult access is. I mean, the reality is we've been running our healthcare system and our hospitals like hotels, maximum occupancy. So when we had this pandemic and there was a surge in demand and need, we were really prepared for that, right? And so in this state, Massachusetts, as you know, the National Guard was called out, and they were, you know, putting pop-up hospitals and beds and tents, you know, in fields, right? And that starts to feel a little like a third world nation when we can't get the medications we need and the tests we need. And it really strained the system. And then as a psychiatrist, of course, there's the second pandemic, which is the mental health crisis, which was already a significant situation before the pandemic, and it's only gotten worse.
So because of your Mass General affiliation, I'm sure you're aware of Home Base, the program with the Red Sox and Mass General that is supporting of veterans' health care issues.
Yeah.
What can you speak about regarding the severity of veterans' health care issues and obviously the impact on their families, and how important is this? And is it being, you know, neglected as individuals maybe move on to other things that are more important?
Well, I think the number one issue for the veterans in this country is really trauma. You know, we've gotten so much better with technology to prevent deaths in the battlefield, but we haven't really figured out how to prevent the trauma associated with battle and being apart from loved ones for long periods of time, and the challenges with deployment. And one of the areas, one of the startups I was involved in, was looking at the predictors of suicide in vets. And so what we know is that the highest risk for suicide in veterans is not while they're deployed in the field, because they have the structure and the meaning and purpose of being part of something. It's actually when they're finished, right? The transition to the real world after being deployed for a long time, they're a tremendous risk. So we were working on an app that would treat and identify depression and PTSD and suicide risk factors to try to help the men and women as they made that transition.
Well, we salute what Mass General and the Red Sox and Home Base and General Hammond, who was a previous guest on the Taking a Walk podcast. We salute what they do for you know, for our veterans. Well, you know, I come from a background of many different formats, many of them music formats. Mm-hmm. And from a standpoint of someone who understands the brain as you do, can you talk about the power of music and what music does for people and why it's so special to mood and help people get through?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about music and the brain is that music does not just light up the auditory cortex, the part of the brain that we use for sound and hearing. It actually stimulates the emotion centers. When it's particularly moving, it can stimulate the reward centers. We often visualize when we're listening to music, so we get the visual cortex involved. And it really lights up many different parts of the brain in a way that other stimuli just don't. And I think that that's probably something that we evolved to learn to love. I think there are people smarter than me who have speculated that you know, early forms of music were a form of communication, because we can remember music better than we can, you know, dry words that are spoken. So, and a lot of music tells a story, right? And we learned in our Interscope days that one of the most effective ways of communicating to people is through stories. And what is a story? A story has a beginning, middle, and end. It has a protagonist, often, who is on a journey, typically overcoming odds and then learning a lesson, and then taking that lesson back to a community and sharing it. And so I think that to the extent that music tells stories, we're wired to hear those things.
So what are some action steps that people can take to kind of rewire themselves as far as, you know, the digital age?
Yeah, I think the most important takeaway, I think, from the book is that we're all at risk because we've all changed our habits in meaningful and significant ways. So there's no one who is not, unless you're one of the few people who don't walk around with a supercomputer in your pocket, at some risk, because these things are so engaging and so powerful and filled with compulsion loops and super stimuli, and are precisely designed to get you hooked and to change your habits. And there's a lot of people who know the same science that I'm trying to tell people to use to help them, using that science to hook them. So we have to be prepared, number one. Number two, we have to think developmentally, right? So every age is unique, right? So the brain at 2 months old and 2 years old and four and through adolescence and then early adulthood and adulthood is constantly changing. And we go through different developmental steps, and we need to apply the principles of developmental neurobiology and psychology to those steps. So for example, I talk a lot in the book about the video transfer deficit. And the video transfer deficit is prior to age 3 years old, young children do not have the brain wiring to take information from a two-dimensional screen, a video or television, and apply it to the real world. So do you remember Baby Einstein?
Yep.
Well, very popular in its day. There was a point at which two-thirds of American households with children had at least one Baby Einstein DVD, and they would take, you know, six-month-olds and put them in front of videos, and they would stare for hours and hours and hours, and parents thought they were doing a great thing. Until a few years later, a big study came out and showed not only were kids who were exposed to Baby Einstein not learning, meaning they weren't getting ahead, they were actually falling behind. And they were falling behind because they weren't learning anything. They were staring, mesmerized by, you know, the objects and movement on the screen, but they weren't getting face-to-face interactions. They weren't getting the adjusted feedback of a live human being. They weren't having touch and play. So the displacement of normal developmental activities that these children were substituting screen time for was a bit of a disaster. And so that's why you don't hear about Baby Einstein anymore, because it didn't work. So that's just one example of how you have to think about where we are developmentally. Let's jump to adolescence, right? So what is the most important thing in adolescence? Well, Erik Erikson said to find meaning and purpose, right? That's what adolescents really want to do. We have to think about what that means in the context of social media, in the context of having friends, in the context of breaking up, in the context of developing an identity. And that gets really complicated really quickly, right? We don't allow children to get in an automobile and drive until they're at least 16 and have, you know, some testing and get a license. But we're gonna give them a supercomputer connected to the internet, and we're going to put them on the information superhighway without any instruction. That's a bad idea. So I think we need to all start to think about digital literacy. And I, for one, support taking a brain science approach to doing it and informing how we make a lot of these decisions.
So last question. If Steve Jobs were alive today, do you think he would look at the world and think, oh my God, look what I was maybe part of creating in terms of this problem?
I think if he was honest with himself, I think he would see it as the mixed bag that it is, right? I'm not against technology. I have an iPhone and I love it. And I love all the wonderful things that you can do with it. I just think we need to be careful about what it's displacing and what it's creating. One of the things I talk about in the book is we have to really move towards human-centered design, right? So instead of technology taking things away from us, they should be empowering us, making us more efficient, having us have better relationships and more connected. You know, we know one thing, and I talk about this in the book, a friend of mine, Bob Waldinger, is now sitting on top of the longest continuous running study of human development in this country. It goes back to the 30s. It was done here in Boston. So it was a cohort of Harvard undergrads and a cohort of inner city males, and they followed them for 80 years. And after 80 years of interviews with them and their family, the big takeaway of what gives people happiness at the end? The quality and number of relationships. And this technology is interrupting relationships. So that's what I worry the most about.
Well, one of the things I'm grateful for with the Taking a Walk series is connecting with new people, but also reconnecting with old friends, and as part of that, learning. I can't thank you enough for everything. Give the book one last push here.
Okay, the book is called Rewired, Protecting Your Brain in the Digital Age. It's available on Amazon from Harvard University Press, so buy it soon.
Dr. Carl Marcy, thank you for taking a walk.
My pleasure.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.